On November 9th through the 11th, the Federal Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Mark Metter, and on behalf of the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group Executive Committee, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. If you're interested in events like this and antitrust law and policy or in corporations and securities law and would like to get involved with the practice group, please reach out to Nathan Kaczmarek. The more the merrier. We take all the help we can get, and especially law students, we'd love to have you join us as well. Before we get started, I do have one brief announcement about CLE. For those of you who are pursuing CLE, we remind you to go to get the credit you need to sign in and out each day, once per day. Signing in and signing out can be done by scanning the QR codes. So if you're pursuing CLE and have not checked in, please be sure to scan the QR code on the back of your convention booklet or on the CLE poster. And if you've already checked in via the QR code, however, there's no need to recheck in. Today's panel is entitled A Creature of Statute, American Antitrust Law. Although a creature of statute, American antitrust law functions in practice as a field of common law. Courts have had the preeminent role in shaping the contours of its application, imposing the rule of reason and defining concepts like competition and the use of economic evidence. While antitrust precedents are closely examined by practitioners and academics alike, less attention is paid to whether the developments in antitrust law over the last century are consistent with the text of the antitrust laws themselves. This panel will discuss the meaning of the antitrust text, how or whether current law is consistent with the plain meaning of the statutes, and what that means for antitrust policy going forward. We are honored to have with us Judge Stefanos Bibas to moderate the discussion. Judge Bibas sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He was previously a professor of law and criminology at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. As director of the Penn Law Supreme Court Clinic, he argued six cases before the Supreme Court of the United States and filed briefs in a dozen others. He graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Columbia University in 1989 with a BA in political theory and from Oxford University in 1991 with a BA in jurisprudence. He then earned his JD from Yale Law School in 1994. After graduating from Yale Law, Judge Bibas clerked for Judge Patrick Higginbotham of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit and Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court and was a litigation associate at Covington and Burlington in Washington, D.C. Thereafter, Judge Bibas served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, where he successfully prosecuted the world's leading expert in Tiffany stained glass for hiring a grave robber to steal priceless Tiffany windows from cemeteries. Before his tenure at Penn Law, Judge Bibas taught at the University of Chicago Law School and the University of Iowa College of Law and was a research fellow at Yale Law School. He has published two books and more than 60 scholarly articles. I will now turn things over to Judge Bibas, who will introduce the panel.
Thank you for that effusive introduction. The most important thing about the introduction is that it did not mention antitrust law. So I'm certainly at a disadvantage relative to our other panelists, and I view my job as getting out of the way relatively quickly to spark an interesting discussion among them. So anyone who hasn't been asleep in a cave as long as Rip Van Winkle knows that the last 30, 40 years have seen a real renaissance of textualism and a focus on what the law says and what it means. And, you know, this is sometimes misunderstood and misdescribed as strict construction or something like that, but Justice Scalia, perhaps the most noted exponent, makes clear the job of the judge is not to construe things strictly or broadly, but fairly according to their terms, as a matter of the separation of powers and understanding of the job, the judge's job is to explicate what the law is, not what it should be. One of those things that the Federalist Society often stresses. And his response often to saying, well, the law is overly broad or it'd be absurd to enforce the law broadly was, well, if we just enforce it according to its terms, the legislature will step in and fix that. And that seems to be the approach that courts take in most areas of law. And then we come to antitrust law. And obviously antitrust law has existed for more than a century. And since the passage of the Sherman Act, courts' attitude has been, well, Congress can't really have meant that because all contracts involve restraint of trade. And so courts have treated it as a delegation to themselves, a self-aggrandizing finding of delegation, to make common law policy. Well, first of all, that's a little odd. Up until shortly before the Sherman Act, the view of courts was, well, common law meant we're not making law, we're just finding it, discovering what's out there, and that's not the way they ever approached antitrust law. But is that legitimate at all? And is that what Congress meant? And even if it is legitimate, and even if it is what Congress meant, how is it that that approach to antitrust law has continued across multiple other antitrust statutes, you know, Robinson, Patman, and Clayton, and the FTC Act, many of which have more specific provisions and yet get read as a continuation of this? And how is it that intellectual fashions, you can look at the late Judge Robert Bork's focus on consumer welfare, et cetera, wind up filtering into the law without any additional lawmaking by Congress? How is that legitimate or consistent with what Congress has done and with the judicial role? And thankfully, we have a panel, a very distinguished panel of people, far more knowledgeable about this to talk about it. Now, they have very lengthy biographies, and I could spend the whole time here reading them, but I think it'd be more interesting if I just give you the top line on them and let them take it away. First, we're going to have Professor Daniel Crane to my immediate right, who's a professor at the University of Michigan Law School, formerly at Yeshiva's Cardozo Law School, who has written very widely, published in the major law reviews, including a noted article on antitrust antitextualism that I think will kick off our discussion about how far we've diverged from it. And then to his right, our second speaker will be Ashley Keller, a fellow former clerk to Justice Kennedy, who was then at Bartlett-Beck, and has gone off, founded litigation finance, and now has his own firm doing plaintiff side work. I have a hard time keeping track of the name of it, but now it's Keller Postman. And so he'll talk a little bit about the limits of textualism and the ways in which conservatives might not, you know, fully appreciate common law adjudication. And then to his right, I'm very pleased to have my former student, Doa Mekki, who is now at the Department of Justice as Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of DOJ, supervising more than 350 lawyers. And she's going to talk some about the practical implications of enforcement, about how enforcement has changed from the Carter administration through the 80s, the drafting merger guidelines, and relations with the FTC, among others. And then to her right, on your far left, we are pleased to have Bilal Sayed, who's the senior competition counsel at Tech Freedom, and formerly was at the Office of Policy Planning at the FTC, and previously in private practice, representing in merger and non-merger matters before the FTC and DOJ, who's also taught as an adjunct professor at the George Mason Antonin Scalia Law School. And he's going to discuss some of the difficulties in finding and adopting a textualist approach, some of the courts and businesses' experiences with near-textual broad readings, and how to be internally consistent in maximizing consumer welfare by protecting the competitive process. So we're going to try to start off with relatively brief 5 to 7 minute overviews. We'll have some plenty of discussion back and forth, and then we hope we will have plenty of time for some questions at the end. So without further ado, Professor Crane.
Thank you, Judge Bibas. It's a pleasure to be here. So as Judge Bibas mentioned, my initial remarks will be drawn from this article I wrote called Antitrust Antitextualism a couple years ago. I will give a very short version of the argument in that article and the backup and much more details available if you'd like to read it. So jurists and scholars of statutory interpretation typically fall into one of two broad camps. You have textualists who follow techniques like plain language, grammatical rules, and canons of interpretation in service of determining what a statute means. And you have purposivists who follow a broader set of techniques like looking at legislative history in service of fulfilling the legislature's purposes. So although the debate over textualism and purposivism rages throughout much of the statutory world, that debate has not characterized at all antitrust law. That's because from the beginning, the courts have followed neither approach. That is to say, they have habitually disregarded both what Congress said and what Congress meant in interpreting the antitrust laws. Rather than being either textualist or purposivist, the courts have followed what is largely understood as a common law process, where judges update their interpretations of the statutes based on evolving economic learning over time. Now, that may be a legitimate way, in principle, to interpret statutes that are open textured or indeterminate, and that's true in some places of the antitrust laws, but that's certainly not always true of the antitrust laws. There are many places where the statutes plainly say something, or that Congress apparently meant something, and the courts have said or done something entirely different, justifying all of it as part of this common law process. So, in the article, I give many examples of this. In the interest of time, I'll just highlight a few here. In the first antitrust case to reach the Supreme Court, Trans-Missouri, in 1897, Justice Peckham's opinion held that Section 1 of the Sherman Act, which prohibits, quote, every contract, combination, or conspiracy restraint of trade, end quote, means what it says. The word every is categorical and does not allow a defendant to argue that a particular restraint of trade is reasonable, since the statute doesn't mention reasonableness. Very quickly, however, the Supreme Court backed off of Justice Peckham's textualism and read a rule of reason into Section 1. Now, you don't have to believe me that this is untextual. The court has repeatedly said it's not textual. In fact, at one point, Justice Stevens went so far as to say, quote, the language of Section 1 of the Sherman Act cannot mean what it says. Now, the rule of reason is the best-known example of judicial defiance of legislative text, but maybe it's the weakest one, because one could make an argument that although not textually faithful, the court at least was faithful to Congress's purpose. After all, many people in Congress in 1890 said that they meant to adopt the common law, and the common law did, in fact, recognize a rule of reason. Now, I think it's pretty dubious to rely on the legislative history of the Sherman Act. Robert Bork did that and has been pilloried ever since. But even if you try to argue that the Sherman Act and the rule of reason can be rehabilitated on purposivist grounds, the case gets far more difficult, I would say impossible, when we start considering subsequent antitrust statutes. Let's take an example from the Clayton Act of 1914. Section 4 allows, quote, any person injured in their business or property, end quote, to sue for treble damages. Notwithstanding the language allowing a suit by any person, the court has imposed significant standing hurdles, such as the requirement that the plaintiff be a direct purchaser or otherwise have suffered a direct injury. No effort at all has been made to justify these standing rules based on text, legislative history, or any other conventional technique of statutory interpretation. The FTC Act of 1914 in Section 5 prohibits, quote, unfair methods of competition. What's the important word? Unfair. What word has been entirely written out of the statute by judicial decision? Unfair. Over time, the courts have completely read fairness out of unfair methods of competition, even though that's in the text and clearly what Congress meant. And then we have the Robinson-Patman Act of 1936. After several decades of enforcing the statute the way it was written, the courts have essentially read it down to go no further than the Sherman Act. I challenge anyone in this room to defend that either textually or from a purposivist perspective. You just can't. I could go on, and there's a lot more in the article, but in the interest of time, let me turn to an even more provocative assertion. Not only have the courts persistently disregarded the antitrust statute's texts and purposes, they have almost uniformly done so in a way that has favored big business. Most of the examples in my article are about ways in which the courts limited the reach of the antitrust laws, reduced damages exposure, or made the antitrust laws tools against labor interests. Now, at this point, people in the room are wondering how this Marxist got invited to the panel. I can assure you I'm not a Marxist, but I do think it's important for conservatives and for everyone else, too, to be honest about what has happened with the interpretation of the antitrust laws. Now, speaking of conservatives, I want to preempt an argument that has circulated at various times, which is that this kind of disregard of statutory intent and purpose must come from conservatives. Certainly, people associated with the Chicago School and conservative judges have been guilty of this, but there are many, many other key actors who are not conservative at all, just to name a few. Louis Brandeis, Harlan Stone, Thurgood Marshall, John Paul Stevens, William Brennan, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Hardly a rogues gallery of conservatives. So if this is not a conservative putsch, what's happening here? My hypothesis is that this is an outworking of two competing impulses in American politics. There's a Jeffersonian impulse that favors the small, the local, and the distributed. There's a Hamiltonian impulse that favors the large, the national, and the concentrated. These impulses are in constant tension and contest periodically in different guises. When Congress writes antitrust statutes, it tends to do so in an aspirational Jeffersonian voice. Then the courts come in and accommodate the statutes to the contending Hamiltonian impulse. And then Congress usually acquiesces, so the system continues in this way without raising much political drama. Now, if that's all descriptively correct, it does raise serious normative questions like, is this all democratically legitimate? Let me close with an anecdote that I hope gets at this question. The last time I spoke at the National Lawyers Convention was in 2017, and then Judge Brett Kavanaugh moderated the panel. Right at the end of the panel, I made a very short version of the observation I've made today. In his first antitrust opinion on the Supreme Court, Apple versus Pepper, Justice Kavanaugh started his analysis with the text of Section 4 of the Clayton Act and repeatedly rebuffed arguments that would disregard the statutory text. As his majority opinion stated, quote, we should resolve ambiguity in the direction of the statutory text, end quote. That's the first time since 1897 that the court has struck that chord. My own commitments are textualist in part, but also Burkean, which means I would be reluctant to see the courts radically uproot 130 years of federal common law. But as to new and undecided questions, Justice Kavanaugh gives us a textualist path forward. Thank you.
Mr. Keller.
I'm ready to get a little more radical. So echoing some of Professor Crane's remarks, I'm not a particularly great Christian, but I try, and I'm going to confess my sins here. I am completely guilty of the hypocrisy that he describes. I consider myself a conservative, therefore a formalist and a textualist, and yet when it comes to antitrust law, I've been going along to get along with this entire common law paradigm that we conservatives would never countenance in any other area. The logic goes something like what Professor Crane alluded to. Well, the text of the Sherman Antitrust Act is exiguous. You can't really tell what a contract and restraint of trade is. What does it mean to monopolize? This must be a delegation to Article 3 for them to make it up. We would never tolerate that in any other area. We say that the Constitution doesn't enact Mr. Herbert Spencer's social statics, even though the words due process of law are not particularly self-defining, but apparently the Sherman Antitrust Act enacts Mr. Robert Bork's perspective from the University of Chicago and the antitrust paradox. And we start measuring supply and demand and consumer welfare and read all of these rules of reason into the statutory regime. We wouldn't say that about the freedom of speech. We wouldn't say that about just about any other provision that it's a delegation to Article 3. No disrespect to the Article 3 jurists, the fine ones in this room who are very intelligent and are perfectly capable of applying the Chicago school to economic principles. But that's just not the way we conservatives approach any other area of law. And so we shouldn't do it here. The Sherman Antitrust Act has particular words. Yes, it's not a verbose statute. It's not prolix, so it's not going to have a lot of definitions that are self-defining. But the normal tools of statutory construction that we would insist upon in every other context ought to apply here. And the repercussions of that, if we're serious about taking our principles to their logical conclusion, is we have to be a lot less friendly to big business. Article 3 courts have to be a lot less friendly to big business. Now, the first normative point that I would make is that's just fine if that's what the law requires, and it doesn't matter whether it's good or bad. We should stick to the text and leave it to Congress if they want to change the law. The law is the written text. It's in the statutes at large. The fact that it's old is no excuse. We don't tolerate that with respect to constitutional principles. We don't tolerate it with respect to other statutes. And so we shouldn't tolerate it here. And so kind of end of story. But if you want to consider some of the practical ramifications associated with a more muscular antitrust policy and enforcement regime, There are two things that I would highlight. The first is we commonly talk about all of these rules being invented as a common law matter being good because they take decisions away from judges, they leave things to the free market, there are going to be error costs if we have judges enforcing the text as written. I think it actually cuts completely in the other direction. When you make up a rule of reason and say that a particular practice is going to be a violation of the antitrust laws, depending upon a whole confluence of measurements that we're going to hire really expensive experts to litigate, you have just guaranteed that that case gets past the 12B6, is going to be litigated through summary judgment, there may be a trial, tens of millions of dollars are going to be expended, and no one's going to have clear bright line rules for how they ought to behave, because it all depends on whether the jury believed this expert or that expert that the pro-competitive justifications for the restriction outweighed the anti-competitive effects, which is just gobbledygook. There's no clear guidance to businesses as to how they ought to order their affairs. A bright line set of rules, which is closer to what Congress enacted, is going to be a far superior regime that lowers the costs, at least, of adjudicating things in the Article III courts. The second point that I would make, and I fully admit that I've come to this view recently, and you can say that I've confessed my sins, and this is another one, which is, you know, opportunistic textualism and formalism, but big companies are terrible right now for the causes that we believe in. Does anybody think that it's good that Meta has the influence that it does, that Google has the influence that it does, that Amazon has the influence that it does? And I don't care that Amazon Prime delivers goods really cheaply to our houses. They are terrible for conservatives. They are against everything that we stand for. And so if enforcing the laws as written by Congress and rediscovering that we're textualists and formalists in this moment brings down some of these companies that are engaged in behavior that conservatives should abhor, that's a positive thing, and we should all get on board with it.
All right, Ms. Mick.
All right, then. Thank you so much to the Federalist Society for having me at this wonderful event. I, as Judge Bibas mentioned, am the principal deputy in the Antitrust Division, and my comments briefly will sort of touch on the practical realities of some of the pathologies that both Professor Crane and my friend Ashley have identified. I arrived at the Justice Department maybe 8.5 years ago, and I had practiced in a law firm, and one of my first assignments was to prepare some of the legal analysis and a recommendation memo. And I thought, well, I'm very well suited to do this. I know how to marshal the law, I know how to do legal research, and I know how to apply facts to the law. And it turned out that this was my first foray into the culture of antitrust enforcement in the agencies. And what I learned was that there was an intense focus on economic theories of harm, backing facts into stylized models of economic harm, and comparatively little, really very little, focus on legal research, engaging the actual text of the antitrust laws, be it the Clayton Act or the Sherman Act, which I think we'll have occasion to talk about how those statutes are actually quite different in terms of their approach and construction. And I also learned curious things, like people in the agencies weren't fond of citing Supreme Court precedent that had not been disturbed by the Supreme Court itself or by congressional action because it is old. And a real focus on case law, again, to the extent that it was cited, that was adjudicated after the 1980s or so. And so if you are intellectually curious, if you have reverence for the law, if you care deeply and passionately about the American people, as I do, it leads you down a rabbit hole of trying to figure out why things are the way they are, or as the youth say, why are we like this? And so I agree with so much of what both Ashley and Professor Crane have identified. We are neither textualists nor purposivists. We don't lean into the legislative history of the Sherman Act very often. I think sometimes you can find interesting statements of normative values in the legislative history, but I will tell you, because I've tried to do it, it's ugly reading. And I have also been concerned about antitrust exceptionalism. I think it leads to particular pathologies that are very uncomfortable for those of us who grew up in the executive branch. Many of you are familiar with the fact that there was sort of a built-up approach to antitrust law and adjudication in the courts, and I'm going to hazard a guess that my friend Bilal will criticize some of that work, but there was nonetheless a hard departure from approaches to the text and adjudication of the Supreme Court starting around the 1980s. And I think that for all of us who are concerned about things like the rule of law, about democratic legitimacy, I think that we should worry hugely about a regime that gives the executive branch license to depart radically from the text of statutes and from Supreme Court precedent. All of us take an oath on day one to support and defend the Constitution, and we are mandated to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And I have a lot of concern about what it means to willfully, wantonly ignore the law as Congress wrote it and as the high courts have interpreted it. You should also be concerned about what appears to be a one-way ratchet. I think Professor Crane talked a little bit about this. No matter where you come out on what the Sherman Act is and what it's intended to do, almost immediately you have courts saying, well, Congress could not have possibly meant what it wrote. And Congress follows up after passing the Sherman Act in 1890. I think it's universally accepted there's frustration about how the Sherman Act was being interpreted, including in the 1911 Standard Oil case. I just, as a small aside, I went down the rabbit hole of looking in newspaper archives and how the reaction to the Standard Oil case was received in the courtroom when the High Court read the decision, and there was disappointment. Why? Because the Supreme Court said that only unreasonable restraints of trade were unlawful. And Congress passes the Clayton Act in 1914, and it's a list, right? The Clayton Act actually prescribes a set of offenses that violate the Clayton Act. And so here's Congress again saying, we are serious about the enforcement of the antitrust laws. And once again, you have courts kind of downgrading what passes muster, or I'm sorry, what is declared unlawful under the Clayton Act. And then again, you have the Seller-Kefauver Anti-Merger Act. It's right in the name, in 1950. And it doesn't take long before courts decide that certain kinds of merger enforcement under Section 7 of the Clayton Act weren't actually unlawful, notwithstanding the fact that Congress is clear about its concern about trends towards oligopoly, trends towards concentration, and concern that if we do not arrest the trends of concentration and their incipiency, it is a threat to our free enterprise system. And that's almost a quote. And then the final point I would raise to all of you, and to try to bring this home, and why I think this conversation is relevant, is that the outcomes haven't been great in recent years. I did a literature review, and over again, you have a thoughtful, bipartisan spectrum of scholars and practitioners who point to areas of the law where the courts have just gotten it wrong and elevated the formalism that the courts themselves have built up to find very strange outcomes under the antitrust laws. And I should also say, someone much smarter than me once pointed out that Americans look to antitrust law when we are uncertain about the future. And it's not far from my mind that we had a massive economic crisis in 2008 and 2009. There is lots of writing about an uneven recovery. There's the massive demand-side market failure that the COVID pandemic ushered in. And there's also the really interesting fact, and at the risk of sounding a little bit like I'm observing on the outside. I don't consider myself a conservative, but I think conservatives kind of come to antitrust law because of concern about big tech in particular, and concern about the ability of these massive companies to control the information that we consume. And so going back to some of those normative values, we're mindful of things like Senator Sherman's discussion on the floor of the Senate about how monopoly is a kingly prerogative, and if we wouldn't have monopoly in the form of political power, we shouldn't tolerate monopoly over the, and kings over the necessities of life. And so all of this is very interesting. I'm excited by a new generation of people who are excited about antitrust law, and I look forward to a discussion about how all of this is relevant at the agencies.
Wonderful. Mr. Sayed.
Well,
I do disagree with a lot of what I heard, and I think my main disagreement is that, you know, it seems very clear to me that the statutes are not an exercise in definitions, but in evaluating the effects of certain conduct. I mean, I think it's a bit of a trope to say the Sherman Act prohibits every contract in restraint of trade, and every contract is a restraint of trade. You know, the focus in Section 1, for example, should be on, is this conduct or contract affect a restraint of trade, right? So I would ask, in a sense, of people who I think sort of misread initially Section 1 of the Sherman Act, and I'll even ask Doha this, because I think there's an opportunity for justice to really push back. Who on this panel, who in this audience, would treat the BMI case differently, right? If you're not aware of that case, this was the development of a joint license for, you know, the use of music, basically, right? Rather than negotiating with each individual composer or author or publisher, you know, the association of these entities agreed to license, in a sense, the catalog of music under specific terms. I mean, the court says this is literal price fixing, but does not adopt that type of analysis. It looks to the effect. Did it restrain trade, right? People, I think, brush too quickly over that language, restraint of trade, right? Every contract is not a restraint of trade. The examples that people give, two lawyers come together and form a firm and decide, of course, they will not compete against each other in the provision of legal services, but jointly offer services as a partnership. Who thinks that is a restraint that allows for a different type of output? So in the Clayton Act, in the Robinson-Patman Act, there is a list of conduct that may be illegal. It's not that all tying is illegal. It's not that all exclusive dealing is illegal, but tying and or exclusive dealing or price discrimination that has an effect on competition, that lessens competition or arguably tends to create a monopoly. This is a factual inquiry, not a textual inquiry. I mean, it is, now I agree that early case law that developed sort of this distinction about reasonable and unreasonable restraints of trade looks like it's departing from the statutory language, and I think it does. But I think what they're trying to do is identify this, you know, focus on either, is this a restraint? Is this an attempt to monopolize? Is this a monopoly, right? And I want to come back to that. Scholars have suggested that it is clear what Section 2 means, that Section 2 is a no-fault monopolization statute. And Bob Land has done a nice article on this, both himself and with Richard Zerbe. But even there, where they look to, you know, they sort of treat Scalia's approach, they take Scalia's approach seriously and look to you know, dictionary definitions. Even there, you see either of two things. A monopoly is all, right? And we have very few monopoly cases that turn on whether someone has 100% of the market. Or they turn on the ability to exclude or control. And those are factual questions, not definitional questions. Looking to the text tells you absolutely nothing, except that you need to do an evaluation of effects. So that this doesn't even seem like a hard question to me. And the focus on textualism strikes me as a red herring, and also significant unfamiliarity with how cases develop. Now, I said that there is a period where the Supreme Court attempts something like a textual framing or interpretation of the act, and this is in the roughly 30-35 year period starting in around 1940 and ending in around 1975, where almost every type of conduct was alleged to be per se, every type of conduct presented to the court was identified as per se illegal, right? Again, I'd ask the textualists up here, Topco, formation of a joint purchasing entity, right? And they say, look at the mergers that came out of the 60s and 70s. There was no effects analysis. It was either this looking to congressional intent that Doha mentions, not in the statute, right? Or quite limited market shares where the court just failed to look at the effects of the analysis, right? Did a merger lessen competition? Did a tying arrangement lessen competition? Did an exclusive dealing lessen competition? Or alternatively, under Section 1, did they restrain trade? Even the price discrimination language in the Robinson-Patman Act is qualified by the need to show a lessening of competition, right? Or tend to create a monopoly. Now, Robinson-Patman Act jurisprudence went wrong when they accepted, you know, that harm to a firm, harm to a competitor, right, is harm to competition, right? So I'll stop there. I will say one thing. I think of myself as a conservative, and that I won't upend the development of law over 130 years so casually by a misreading or refusal to fully read a statute. But I'll also say, even as a conservative, I like Google, I like Meta, and I like Amazon, and it is unclear to me what they are doing that may be outside of their business conduct should require the use of antitrust statutes to penalize them. All right. Anyway, so I'll stop there.
So this is a great start for discussion, and I think Bilal and Ashley's comments and those too highlight some different strains within conservatism. And, you know, we forget that Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican president and was a populist kind of trust buster. And so when we think about, Dan called it the kind of Jeffersonian vision versus Hamiltonian, or you could call it idealistic versus pragmatic, have conservatives been seduced by a vision of Chicago maximizing economic efficiency, cost-benefit analysis here in a way that, you know, when you look at the Delaney Clause in environmental law, it looks extreme. And courts find a way to do some kind of, you know, are we going to really enforce it to the letter? Or should conservatives just say, look, that's a matter of whatever comes out of the process, and maybe cutting big businesses down to size is good, or maybe we should just trust in lobbying to take care of it. So should courts have backed away? Should they still back away from kind of a Borkian, you know, maximizing welfare economic efficiency approach in the name of fidelity to these other goals?
You asking me? Yes.
Well,
and I think there was a little bit of a straw man in some of the previous remarks. No one is suggesting that there aren't going to be facts that are relevant in antitrust cases. You can't just read the text and say, we're done here. The question is, are we being faithful to what the words in the statutes at large mean so that we can deduce which facts are relevant for purposes of determining liability at an antitrust trial? So I'm not suggesting that the answer is you just look at the words and you think really hard and you use the normal tools of statutory construction and then we're done. We have lots of statutory regimes where you do that, and then you have a trial. and both sides get to present their views, and there are facts that are relevant. But the notion that, you know, supply and demand and where they meet and the lines underneath that define consumer welfare are the end-all be-all is just incompatible with what Congress chose to write into our statutes and to make our law. It's not to say that it's entirely irrelevant, but those are not the only things that define a restraint of trade. They are definitely not the only things that define what it is to monopolize or attempt to monopolize. And I haven't heard anybody say that that's a faithful reading of the statutory text. So if we're going to be faithful conservatives, I think we have to apply the same rules in this statutory context that we do in every other context. And then we can have the debate about stare decisis, and obviously reasonable minds can differ. I think stare decisis is Latin for conservative unilateral disarmament, and I just won't abide by it. But I respect the other view.
Well, I don't think what I proposed was a straw man. I think what I proposed was the statute says you look at the effects of, you know, conduct to see if it meets the requirement of a restraint of or on trade or a lessening of competition. This is an effects-based analysis, not a textual analysis. I also am not, I don't think I used the term consumer welfare at all in what I said. And I think very few district court, appellate court, or even Supreme Court opinions use the term consumer welfare. And I think is also both, I can say this for certainty about my practice, and I think I can say this with near certainty for your practice, I never tried to evaluate the consumer welfare effects of conduct by a client or who a client might be complaining of. I said, let's talk about effects on price, output, innovation, right, and related topics. I drew no triangles in my career as a practicing lawyer or in my time at the FTC. I never measured the area of a triangle versus the area of a rectangle, right? I never did that, and courts don't do that. Courts do and should do an effects-based analysis. That has been the conservative revolution in antitrust, not the adoption of a consumer welfare standard, right? It has been the adoption of looking to actual effects rather than just looking at characterization of conduct. And that is conservative, right? Get to the right answer, not some made-up answer. So I think the consumer welfare Borkian approach or discussion is sort of either straw man or red herring. I love the antitrust paradox, but economics has passed beyond that.
Is price fixing illegal?
Price fixing is illegal.
Where does the statute say that?
It doesn't say that. It's an effect.
Oh, okay. But okay.
It's an effect-based analysis.
But how do you know that the effects are negative?
And how? From empirical analysis.
But every time?
And
per
well,
se?
We don't. Okay.
That's on the statute either.
We don't. Okay. So what? We don't evaluate all so-called price fixing as per se illegal, right? I mean, I mentioned the BMI case, the BMI ASCAP license. That was characterized as clearly per se, clearly literal price fixing. But of course, the court looked at that and said, wait, this increases output. This increases something new, right? I would be fine with actual analysis of all so-called price-fixing agreements to see what their effect was. The courts have adopted administrative rules to make such trials either manageable or sort of unnecessary to go over the same question repeatedly. You know, but if your argument is it is a conservative position to evaluate every price-fixing allegation sort of on an effects-based analysis each time, okay, that's fine. Doesn't sound very
conservative.
Let's
hear from our other speakers. Yeah. Doa.
Absolutely.
So I guess I've I've sort of lost the plot a little bit in this discussion, but I think the challenge I'm having with Bilal's commentary is that you seem to set up the straw man that everything in antitrust or a textualist approach to antitrust means that we just have a framework of per se offenses, when it's actually the case that it's the very narrow minority of antitrust violations that are subject to a per se framework, and we do fact development and application of facts to the law in the vast majority of our other cases. But I think the issue...
I agree 100% with that, to be clear.
That's good. It wasn't clear, like, a couple of minutes
ago. I said it's an effects-based analysis.
I think the more interesting issue, though, is I think Ball's concerns about what the text of the statute says and doesn't say. And Dan's really wonderful article talks about the common law nature of the term restraint of trade, which did have a meaning at common law. And you can look to, I'm not sure how this room feels about this source, but you can look to the first restatement of contracts that I think is typically held up as authoritative and compelling, at least in its recitation of the state of the common law. And it had very specific meanings. And we know that the restraint of trade roughly fell into five buckets of malum prohibitum, an antitrust world, or malum in se. And only one of those, strictly speaking, was economic, right? It had the multi-object goals of the restraint of trade. And so from a lot of that, we derive our rules in antitrust, and it's really, I think, well canvassed in Judge Taft's opinion in Addison Pipe in the Sixth Circuit from 1899. And so I think the more interesting discussion that we should be having is whether antitrust is a body of law that's a sort of empty vessel to be filled by judges. And I think that is wrong. There are numerous downsides to that kind of approach, and I think it's curious that the arch-textualist, Justice Scalia, seemed to be okay with that sort of framework, and I would posit that we've never had a strictly textualist approach to antitrust, and it's really a conversation that is starting now because you have two agency heads, FTC Chair Lena Khan and Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor, my boss, who have pledged to administer the antitrust laws in a manner that is faithful to the text of the statute and the interpretations of the highest courts. And it is curious that there has been backlash about that, and it's kind of precipitated this debate about what the statutes actually mean and what the goals of antitrust are.
Dan.
So we've been just too polite. I want to pick a fight with all three of my co-panelists. So Doha doesn't like the outcomes of the recent cases. I kind of do. Ashley doesn't like big tech. I kind of do. So I'm kind of with Bilal on the merits of lots of this stuff. But Bilal, okay, Robinson-Patman Act. Let me read you the language. I was thinking about bringing slides. We actually have text up here. Since we're talking about textualism, I should have done that. Here's what the Robinson-Patman Act says. Anyone who injures, destroys, or prevents competition with any person who either grants or knowingly receives the benefit of such discrimination or with customers of either of them has violated the statute. The Robinson-Patman Act in 1936 amended the Clayton Act precisely to allow a suit of injury to an individual business person, not to competition generally. And that's the way in Morton Salt the Supreme Court interpreted. Morton Salt is an appalling opinion to me as a matter of policy. It is textually correct. And now the Supreme Court has read that out. Primary line price discrimination is just predatory pricing. That's Brook Group. And then secondary line price discrimination requires a showing of harm to competition generally. That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Reeder Simcoe. So, I mean, I get the point about the Sherman Act. We can have that conversation about effects. That may make sense. But it's really hard to go through the Clayton Act, through the Robinson-Patman Act, to the FTC Act, and say, well, the text supports a standard of effects and general harm to competition. Certainly, it's the Robinson-Patman Act that is just not plausible in the face.
All right, so since I'm a judge, I'm interested in what I'm supposed to be doing. And we judges are, descriptively, Is your analysis that we're, in essence, making policy on what is going to lead to the best effects? And if that's true, normatively, even if Congress meant to delegate this to us, how under the Constitution do we have the power to make these decisions that have this massive effect on the structure of American business? Or am I being too dark and too pessimistic in my read of the situation?
Well, I think you're being a little too dark. I think there is a framework to evaluate the effects of conduct, and courts do the best job they can, or at least try to do the best job they can, in evaluating effects. I think courts get it wrong when they turn to, you know, sort of a what I'd call a language analysis of the statutes, right? If you accept the idea that the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act, and the FTC Act require some type of effects analysis, then I think courts are doing fine. You know, they may get it wrong, but, you know, they're operating within that framework of an effects analysis. It's helpful if the agencies or scholars, you know, help develop that framework. Courts should take notice of it, think about it. But this doesn't seem in any way controversial to me.
Yeah, I mean, Congress knows how to delegate to you. The Rules Enabling Act does it. Screw up the rules of civil procedure all you want. You have that power. But this was not a delegation. It looks like any other statute. I mean, I think the answer to your question is, very flippantly, you should decide cases or controversies. And you should rely on us as litigants and practitioners to present arguments to you. And you cannot be faulted for not getting to the what I believe is the right answer under the text if we don't tee that up for you and say, look, this is the faithful reading of what the Sherman Antitrust Act meant in 1890. Here's the proof of it, and here's why my client wins this case. And so it's incumbent on all of the practitioners here, and I commend Doha and her colleagues for being faithful stewards of, I think, our nation's antitrust laws and taking care that the laws are faithfully executed. We've got to do the work as litigants to empower you to reach the right judgments in cases or controversies. And if we don't do it, if we just cite the effects and we throw a bunch of experts in front of you and you measure output and you decide, yep, in this two-sided market, I've determined that there are more pro-competitive effects than anti-competitive effects because that's how the case was framed, then it's not on you, it's on us. But we have to do our jobs and give you the tools that you need to properly adjudicate these cases.
I completely agree with that. Look, I think that nobody is concerned. I hope no one is concerned about the kind of ordinary judicial gap filling that I think happens across all manner of statutes and cases that are presented, particularly to district court judges. I think, again, it's this idea that there was a broad delegation by Congress to the courts to fashion rules. I think it is in vogue now to think about congressional delegation or non-delegation, such as it is. And my really wonderful colleagues who are sitting out there gave me a lot of sort of adjacent areas of law to dig into and think about how we interpret the Sherman Act. And I went down the rabbit hole of reading the Gorsuch dissent in Gundy. And there's one part in particular that really jumped out at me. Two parts, actually. The first was sort of a preference for a stricter test for non-delegation, but also this line that if the separation of powers means anything, it must mean that Congress cannot give the executive branch a blank check to write a code of conduct governing private conduct for 500,000 people. And that was a case about a sex offender registry. And when we think about our job, which is to police the whole of the U.S. economy, a really glorious thing that we are all very proud of, we need to be especially careful about the rules that we expect that Congress has fashioned in the past and the way that we present our cases and ask judges to do their jobs.
Yeah, so I teach contracts. That's the other thing I teach. And I have no problem with the fact that for hundreds and hundreds of years, the courts followed a truly common law process. There was no underlying statute. Lots of interesting questions about, like, how do you reform in a common law system where it's inherently based on following precedent? And so looking to the past. So those are technique questions, legitimacy questions, but overall, we have a very long common law tradition. I don't see a real problem with the idea that antitrust law could be common law, so the way it's worked. My problem is that's not what Congress has said in many cases, and we're treating it as if it's this kind of contracts or torts or property common law, which there was a common law restraint of trade preceding the Sherman Act, but since that time, Congress has actually intervened and said more specific things. So that's the legitimacy problem I have, and it's a principle problem, which is why do we get to do it here and ignore what Congress has said here? And then in other areas when it's, you know, the outcomes are not ones favored by conservatives, we yell and scream about it. So that's, to me, that's the principal consistency point. We can't continue to pretend that Congress hasn't said to us things in the antitrust statutes that we don't like. We have a choice to make. What do we do about them? The other thing I'll just say is stare decisis to me is really important. I think this has come up in several of our points here, but I don't, certainly not, you know, on the Third Circuit, Judge Bibas, would you have the authority to start, you know, reversing what the Supreme Court has said? And even at the Supreme Court level, I wouldn't be comfortable with, let's start all over again. Let's go back to 1890, pretend this didn't happen. It did happen. The question is how we move forward now. And so I don't think this is so much about getting back as it is moving forward. But I think that what Judge Kavanaugh did in Pepper, you know, as to this issue before me today, I'm going to start insisting a little bit more on textualism, really is the way forward.
All right, I've got one more question, and then we'll throw it open to the floor. So please think of your questions, and we have a microphone in the back that you can line up at if you like. So let me focus on Doha. Let's talk about enforcement agencies, as you were just talking about what litigants bring to the court. So the agencies have an interesting role here, and, you know, two parts of the U.S. government. Ashley represents some state governments, so maybe you want to chime in on that as well. So sometimes the agencies join force with pragmatic courts and reading down the statutes, but at other times, like the FTC in the 70s and 80s, the agencies are fighting more for the plain reading against the courts. So if the courts are being anti-democratic by reading down statutes, if Congress isn't doing anything about it, are the agencies a solution here? Are they really helping this conversation to evolve, and is it appropriate for us to be trusting the agencies to vindicate the text of the statutes if the courts, at least historically, haven't been?
It's a great question. First, let me exercise some humility and say, look, the agencies have participated in this very odd dance that we've been doing over the last century or so. And as we sort of look to the future, fidelity to the law, I think, looks different at the two antitrust agencies. Again, I grew up in the executive branch. I work at the Justice Department. I love the Justice Department. You feel like you work in the executive branch. Your role is to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Congress has not given us rulemaking authority. Congress has not given us authority to conduct studies and markets. Conversely, over at the FTC, their enabling statute gives them it is truly a creature of administrative law, and I think there's a greater case to be made that Congress specifically delegated certain of its authorities to the FTC to include case-by-case adjudication of competition statutes, including principally the FTC Act, but also the ability to fashion rules to govern unfair methods of competition or certain UDAP principles, and to conduct studies. And so, you know, I won't speak for my colleagues at the FTC, but for those of us working in the antitrust division, we can't disregard the 130 years or so of law that has been built up. You know, in addition to being faithful to the will of Congress, we have a duty to obey the precedent as it exists. And so all we can do is be clear about our intentions, to bring the best cases that we possibly can, to bring compelling narratives, to compel judges to decide in our favor, and to participate in the administration of the antitrust laws in a way that preserves the democratic legitimacy of our work and the democratic nature of our public institution that we hear a lot about.
Ashley, do you want to say anything from the state government perspective?
Not really from the state government perspective, no. I guess the only thing I would say is respectful disagreement with Doha on the idea that they're bound by judicial precedent. That's a judicial supremacy point. I don't buy that. The law that they have an obligation to take care of that is faithfully executed is in the statute book. That's the law. What the Supreme Court says the law is not the law. There may be practical reasons for the agencies not to spend their precious resources, which are limited, on, you know, tilting at windmills and trying to ignore precedent where they have no chance of success, but the law is the law. The court's interpretation of the law is just an interpretation, and it's only binding in the case or controversy in front of the court. I know that is not necessarily the most popular view outside of the Mayflower today, but I bet I have some supporters in the room today.
I'd like to just add one thing. So another question is prosecutorial discretion not to bring cases that you don't like, but that the statutes authorize. So the Robinson-Patman Act. There has not been a DOJ or FTC Robinson-Patman case since the 1980s. Now, there is currently an FTC investigation of Coke and Pepsi under the Robinson-Patman Act. Don't know what's going to happen there. But there are, you know, 40 years of desuetude, right? Just, we don't like the statute, we're just not going to enforce it. Now, that raises not an interpretive question. That raises a legitimacy question of the take care question of whether the agencies can just decide not to enforce a statute that they don't like. So another whole angle on this as well.
All right. So now we're going to turn to questions. And as judge, I ask that you announce your name and, if you like, where you're from and maybe who you're addressing. But then after that, a question. Max, three sentences. The sentences may not be concatenated with a series of em dashes and semicolons. And there should be a question mark reflected by a rising vocal inflection at the end of the third sentence. Josh Kleinfeld.
Can I just walk away at this point? This might be too hard. Thanks, everyone. That was a fascinating panel. My name is Josh Kleinfeld. I'm a professor at Northwestern Law School and now at George Mason Law School as a visiting professor. I have a methodological question for everyone on the panel. I was finding myself sort of thinking as I sat, what if the Sherman Act had been a constitutional amendment instead of a statute? And what if, frustrated with the courts, the country had followed up with the Clinton Act as a second constitutional amendment? And then, presumably, as conservatives, we would take an originalist approach, and that would be some mixture of thinking about the, we'd reconstruct the history of the two amendments, we'd scrutinize the intent of those who passed it, the public meaning of the words they uttered, and the big idea under the big idea historically underlying the amendments they passed, the way we do with, say, the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments. My question, it's a genuine question, what would the law look like in this area in that case, and how would that be a more promising direction than statutory, than the textualist approach three of you have proposed on this panel?
Any thoughts?
I don't think it'd be more promising at all, and I think the law would probably evolve in the same way it has evolved. I mean, you know, Herb Hovenkamp has also looked at this question of, you know, what did these terms mean at the time they were enacted, which I think is similar to what you would do if this was a constitutional provision. And, you know, my reading of his work and my experience is simply you look to things like, you know, that you would do an effects-based analysis, and as your analytical tools to perform those effects-based analysis improves, outcomes may change. There certainly is some opportunity for improvement in the way the courts describe maybe the burdens on a plaintiff or on a defendant, but those don't strike me as so clearly textual questions or determinative whether it's a statute or a constitutional provision. But it seems to me you get to the same place, that you know you do an effects-based analysis, because that's That's what the law looked like, I believe, in 1890, and I'm not clear why people are running away from that.
So one question is, as a general matter, what does constitutional interpretation look like that's different from statutory interpretation? Obviously, you assume that the framers of a constitutional amendment or provision speak in a different register than when they write the legislature writing a statute. One of the things about constitutional law and the Sherman Act in particular is that the Supreme Court is described as almost constitutional. There's sort of this language, it's the Magna Carta of free enterprise, so it almost has this quasi-constitutional status. And so maybe one explanation for why the courts have not treated it like an ordinary statute is precisely that they already have thought about it as quasi-constitutional. Now again, that might work as to the Sherman Act. Hard pressed to say that as to say the Robinson-Patman Act.
So I agree with Professor Crane's articulation. I think that if you favor viewing the Sherman Act with sort of like a static historicism, you might get closer to what a constitutional approach to the Sherman Act actually looks like. I think you're bringing in some of the normative values of the day. You are bringing in some of the sort of more romantic ideals about the political economy of the day. And I think that is an issue that is often criticized. People like me are criticized a lot for really elevating those political economy concerns in our rhetoric and in our approach to framing certain kinds of antitrust harms. And just because I can't help myself, I have to say, Jefferson actually wanted a constitutional amendment that would have banned the government grant of monopoly power, and he writes about it in a really interesting way in a letter to his friend James Madison. It's worth a read.
Sir.
Okay, I'd ask what you guys think that antitrust law is basically obsolete and counterproductive in the technical area based on two examples. One is, back in the day, there was a bunch of litigation against the people who made fax paper. And by the time it finally resolved, nobody used faxes anymore except the Social Security Administration and the hospitals. The rest of us had all switched to email. And the second is the case of WordPerfect, which was the most wonderful word processing program ever in 1991, whereas Microsoft Word was absolute garbage. But through tying, by putting MS Word on every computer, they effectively use their tying to get monopoly, to get total market share. However, the governments didn't do anything timely fashion. By the time the government told Microsoft that they could no longer do this tying, they were the best there was. And the effect was simply that whenever anybody bought a computer, instead of getting their Microsoft Word automatically built in, they had to go pay $100 on top of the cost of the computer. Oh, one more thing, based on what you said.
Is there a question here?
Yes, what do you think?
All right. I think antitrust law is both obsolete and counterproductive in the technological realm.
No.
I say this as my beloved colleagues are downtown right now litigating the Google search monopolization case. I agree with Ashley. The answer absolutely is no. And I think the problem you've described is really a latency problem. And we can get into the reasons why the agencies might be a little bit slower to wield their Section 2 authority. But I think particularly in digital markets, it is more important to bring thoughtful Section 2 cases because digital markets that go to things like the information that we consume can lead to real harms that actually threaten our democratic values if they are not reined in. And I would also note that in technological markets in particular, you think about a technology like search, and we know that, technologies that are on the horizon, or perhaps here, like artificial intelligence, are really made worse off due to a lack of competition in certain input markets, like search, for example.
So this is really off topic, since it's not about the text, but I will just say antitrust law as to big tech is not obsolete today. It will become obsolete because of AI and quantum computing and nanotechnology, but that will not be on Doha's watch.
So, look, I don't think antitrust is obsolete nor counterproductive. I mean, this is a question that's come up now, at least this is the second time in my career, and I don't feel that old, but this came up in, you know, around the Microsoft case. I think some of the points you mentioned, you know, could be addressed if cases moved more quickly. And I think, while I don't think there's a role for Congress in revising or clarifying or changing or, you know, the substance of antitrust law, I do think there is a role for Congress to both to help speed up the disposition of these cases, either or both through more judicial resources, maybe more agency resources, and also through, you know, civil and appellate procedure type improvements.
And short of Congress, you can count on the agencies to bring their cases a little bit faster. We have a separate case proceeding against Google in the Eastern District of Virginia, where we're looking at something like a year between the time of filing and the actual trial of that case, which is extraordinary for civil antitrust cases.
That is a great case that you have there.
I would say one more thing in addition. I mean, you know, my view as a, I mean, I used to think I was conservative. You know, antitrust is an alternative to direct regulation. And, you know, we should get antitrust right to avoid an alternative that Congress and maybe others consider, which is sort of direct regulation of the conduct of these companies or any companies.
All right, sir.
My name is Jonathan Goldstein. I'm an attorney based in the Philadelphia suburbs with a nationwide practice. My question is the analytical framework the same for functioning markets and failing markets? You have two buggy whip manufacturers. They're the last two. They're both losing money. They combine. They're the only one. Now they're making wild monopoly profits. And if the analytical framework is the same, should it be?
I mean, there's a answer to that, Justice Holmes' opinion called window glass, hand-blown glass, and it was in its dying embers in terms of the technology, and Holmes basically says, you know, kind of go on and do what you want because you're going out anyway. Now, your hypothetical imagines that they're not going out just yet, and so for a while they will actually be able to charge monopoly prices, and I think that should still be a problem. But certainly as to a technology that's about to be leapfrogged, where what would have been an anti-competitive merger, you know, a year ago or 10 years ago, it no longer is because they no longer have the capacity to really compete against the new technology, I would go to Bilal's effects point and say there's no anti-competitive effect and therefore no reason to be worried about it.
I mean, I'd say the framework should be the same, and the framework takes account of, you know, sort of these types of effects. Is there competition from outside the market? I mean, I can tell you I feel pretty confident that the FTC and DOJ will approve a merger of two buggy whip companies, right? Because there are alternatives.
All right, ma'am,
thank you.
Hello, my name's Alana. I am a journalist with MLEX Regulatory News Service. I'm gonna frame the question slightly differently for Doha than for the rest of the panelists. But my question to Doha is, based on your reading of the comments on the HSR form and the merger guidelines, where in those two policy documents do you see the possibility of there being changes, and what were the most constructive and interesting suggestions? And then my question for the panelists is, if you had one thing that you would like to see modified in a constructive way in the guidelines or the HSR form, what would that one thing be?
Thank you for the questions. It will not surprise you that I can't really answer them without waiving all manner of deliberative process privileges. But I will say broadly, public comments are extraordinarily useful. We do read every single comment that comes in. I've participated in reading comments on the draft merger guidelines, for example, and It is extraordinary, even when they are critical, because it gives us a chance to improve upon our analysis and make our intentions clearer or better understandable to the public, which is another really important part of our public mission.
I'm for overturning Chevron and bringing back Schechter Poultry, so I don't have any ideas for what the regulators ought to do.
I can answer very quickly as to the draft merger guidelines. I would strike them in their entirety and bring back the 2010 guidelines.
I'd second what Dan said on that, although there are some improvements. This is a little beyond your question, but if there were one change I could make sort of in the courts with respect to antitrust cases, it is this, I think, unsupported and mistaken focus on so-called type 1 error, right? The courts, I don't know what they do outside antitrust, but the courts should, in a abstract way, say, try to minimize the costs of both, you know, type 1 and type 2 errors, right? You don't want to over-enforce, you don't want to under-enforce. And right now, at least in the Supreme Court, you know, a few opinions suggest that courts themselves, appellate courts, should be focused on concerns about over-enforcing the law. And that comes out of nowhere, and I think that has probably been, you know, of significant detriment to the development of the law in a manner that, you know, correctly analyzes the effects of a transaction.
Sir.
Hi, Enrique Carnero. I'm an associate at a large law firm in New York. So my question flows from an earlier exchange between Mr. Sayed and Mr. Keller. So we assume a per se bar on price fixing doesn't flow unambiguously from Section 1 of the Sherman Act. The only way to know that price fixing has a negative effect is by looking at empirical data. So although allowing each set of litigants to contest that in their own cases might seem awkward or maybe stupid, isn't it the most consistent with due process to allow each set of parties to do that in subsequent cases? Like in preclusion, you're usually only bound by a finding of fact if you got to litigate it yourself. So why do we ignore due process here and just jump to an antecedent finding of fact that if it's price fixing, it's always an unreasonable restraint of trade? Thanks.
Yeah. I don't think it's a due process violation to have a judge define what a statute means. And so if Section 1 of the Sherman Act said it shall always be a restraint of trade, a contract and restraint of trade, if there's price fixing, you know, you get your due process to say I didn't do that, but you don't get due process to interpret the words of the statute. That's for the Article 3 judge. And so the point of my exchange was to say, where do these per se versus rule of reason ideas come from? They're not flowing from the statutory text. So I don't have a dog in the hunt with respect to per se versus rule of reason on price fixing. I'm much more interested in grounding what courts do in what Congress actually wrote into our statute book. And then, of course, give litigants their due process within the framework of what the statute means and put the plaintiff to his or her burden of proof. They have to tick off these elements, but those elements should flow from the statute, not from judges looking at economic literature and saying, hey, Bob Bork was a really smart man, and I take a backseat to no one in my love for the late, great Bob Bork. But, you know, he defined all of this and showed that it's better overall for consumer welfare and society if we have these sorts of rules. Therefore, that should be the rule of antitrust. That's not how we should approach statutory interpretation.
So, I mean, I'll just, I'm going to needle Doha here again, sorry, but on per se rules. So one of the virtues of per se rules and due process is that, you know, as to price fixing, which is how we've enforced this now for many decades, the rule is very clear. I mean, what price fixing is, when it'll be criminally enforced, that is, whether or not it's statutorily faithful as a matter of just notice to the world, it's very clear. Now, needling Doha here, you know, Jonathan Cantor at DOJ has made clear he wants to start bringing criminal Section 2 cases for monopolization, and there are no per se offenses. So, you know, either you have to create them and then it becomes clear what they are, or you have to rely on some kind of an effects analysis in bringing a criminal case, which I think would really raise serious due process issues.
I have to respond to that. So, look, Section 2 is a felony statute. We don't have to reach back into the common law because Congress has declared that whoever monopolizes, attempts to monopolize, conspires to monopolize, shall be guilty of a felony, right? It was a misdemeanor until 1975, and then now it's a felony. And even if you have doubts about that, Congress reauthorized the penalties under ACPERA in 2005. And so I would challenge you to think about Section 2 in the criminal context as being no different than any of the myriad offenses under Title 18 of the U.S. Code.
Yeah, textually, what Congress meant and said, like to the earlier point, I don't disagree with you. I was just, in terms of due process, in terms of notice of what that looks like, I think there would be serious challenges if you start bringing criminal Section 2 cases as to conduct that relies extensively upon effects analysis.
I'd also just note that the courts have sort of moved away from per se categorization of conduct. I mean, it's not that all price fixing is per se illegal. I mean, I gave the example of sort of the BMI and ASCAP joint licenses. You know, it's so-called naked price fixing, which it may raise the same question, but in many cases, parties who, you know, do some kind of joint venture contract that does fix prices, they do, in fact, get to argue that the conduct doesn't restrain trade, it creates, you know, additional output, new output. So it, you know, the courts in some sense are sort of moving to give more process in antitrust cases for parties to make, to make an argument that they have not restrained trade.
But there's a framework for that, right? I mean, that's the ancillary restraints test, right? And that's been true since 1899. And so if you plausibly allege that your price fixing isn't really price fixing, but it's actually, ancillary to some like broader pro-competitive or productive venture, then you have an opportunity to present evidence that gets you into that bucket. And so again, I don't think that's the courts moving. I think that's been interpretation of the law since the very end of the 19th century.
Well, I think it is actually the courts moving. I mean, without. Think of some of the price discrimination cases that were criminal. Think of some of the restraint cases that were criminal. I mean, the courts have, and I will say that ancillary, the doctrine of ancillary restraints sort of seemed, to develop differently than sort of the reasonable, unreasonable doctrine of Sherman Act. So. It has been sitting around since 1899, but it wasn't really used until I think Easterbrook and Bork and Posner in the 80s.
Yeah, I Mitchell think that's actually not true, but yeah.
Okay. I think they're different.
And
I think
for our final question, James Burnham, Vallecito Capital.
Yeah, hi. I'm James. I'm a lawyer. I just have a theoretical question. So if you look at the text of the statutes promoting competition, stopping restraints of trade, you might think that the concern was that just excessive consolidation, firms get too big, they become too powerful, they do bad things, and those bad things might be more than just raise prices. And I'm thinking about Google, Meta, and Amazon, which I don't like, and all the things they did during the COVID pandemic, as one example, to suppress information, shape public policy, and basically engage in social engineering on a society-wide basis. Lots of other examples. Is that an antitrust problem? Because it strikes me as a fairly serious societal problem and perhaps an existential threat to the conservative movement. Thank you.
I don't think it's an antitrust problem. I mean, there's nothing in the statutes that seems to touch on that.
But I don't think it's open to question that those failures of competition, subversion of the competitive process, can yield second-order harms that are threatening to our social, political, and economic ideals. And so I don't think anyone was unclear about this, right? Like, you don't have to look for it in the statute. Again, you can look at some of the floor debate. You can look at the fact that, floor debate for the Sherman Act. You can think about the fact that when TR finally wields Section 2 against J.P. Morgan, he says things like, we have to convince the people that we're on their side, right? I mean, there is a, actually, I should commend Dan again. He has just edited a really wonderful volume of essays about antitrust and democracy and presents really wide-ranging views about sort of the political considerations and whether you think they are baked into the statute or sort of exogenous and reflect the sentiment of the time. There's no escaping that competition is viewed with certain political values that you can find all over the 19th century and parts of the 20th century. And I think there's a resurgence of that that brings people to antitrust, and it sort of yields conversations like this.
But just one example of that. I've worked quite a bit in the last few years on the relationship between concentrated economic power and fascism, especially Nazism. And certainly in 1950, at the time of the Seller-Kefauver amendments to the Clayton Act, Congress was very convinced and had 100 antitrust lawyers working in Germany and sort of collecting evidence that there was a tight relationship between the extreme economic concentration of the German economy during the Weimar period and Hitler's rise to power. That's not certainly the only cause, but it was a contributing factor in how Hitler was able to consolidate power. So at a minimum, Congress believed, and we need to act on Congress's belief, that when you get extremely concentrated economic power, it is very difficult to maintain a government without extremely concentrated political power, that is to say, the end of democracy. So I absolutely think that, again, this is whether it's a textualist question or just a matter of democratic urgency, but we need to think about the relationship between powers of all kind.
But this is clearly not a textual analysis of the statute. Or am I missing that?
Well, monopolize.
In Brown Shoe, the Supreme Court includes it. It's not textual. It's legislative history. This goes back to purposivism versus text. If you are a purposivist and you believe in legislative history, which Scalia did not, but Bork did, right? Here's the irony. The Supreme Court adopts a consumer welfare standard in 1979 in Reeder versus Sonatone, citing Bork, who's all about not the text, but the legislative history. And then this is shortly before people like Scalia, of course, argue we don't look at legislative history. So the consumer welfare standard is not built upon statutory text. At best, it's built upon a purposivist reading of legislative history. That raises another whole set of questions.
Monopolize or attempt to monopolize. There's your text. I don't need any history. They're too big.
I don't.
It's an active verb, to eyes means conduct.
I'd also just to note.
They didn't just appear big out of the ether.
Just to note,
Alcoa.
I think
textualist, learned hand.
I think there's a difference between Bork and Scalia on this. I mean, I think people have, I mean, you can read Business Electronics. Scalia, you know, focuses on, I think, an effects-based analysis, not, which I believe comes from the statute, comes from the text, and not, you know, a Bork's legislative history approach in creating the consumer welfare standard.
I would also just note, Congress is allowed to legislate around populist ideas. There are lots of times where Congress is a little bit vague, a little bit folksy, and that has nothing to do with canons of construction or statutory interpretation. There are ideals baked into the statute, and so I think it is important to remember that this is not the kind of thing that comes from nowhere. And I don't think any of us who, I think I'm willing to put myself in this category of favoring a more textual approach to antitrust, that doesn't mean that we can't look to other sources to do the kind of gap filling of what antitrust is supposed to do. I think Business Electronics is the seminal example of the like antitrust as a vessel to be filled with policy goals and content by judges. And so again, it's just, it is the oddity of Scalia, the archtextualist, fashioning sort of a rulemaking power for Article III. It's extraordinary.
This has been a fascinating discussion. Please join me in thanking the panel.